Welcome to the Practical Futurist Podcast, a bi-weekly show all about the near-term future with practical advice from a range of global experts to help you stay ahead of the curve. Every episode answers the question, what's the future of? With voices and opinions that need to be heard. Your host is international keynote speaker and practical futurist, Andrew Grill.
Welcome to episode 14 of the Practical Futurist Podcast. My guest today is Jeremy Epstein, CEO of Never Stop Marketing, and he's got 20 years of international marketing experience. Most recently, Jeremy was VP Marketing at Sprinklr, which grew from a $20 million valuation and 30 people to $1.8 billion valuation and 1,400 people in 4 years, which is pretty remarkable. Today, Jeremy's a sought-after marketing advisor in the crypto and blockchain industry and has worked with some of the leading and most innovative projects, including OpenBazaar and D-Corp. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, Jeremy, we've known each other for a while, and I think most of the guests, we sort of start off with how we've known each other. We came across each other at Sprinklr. I think I was either at IBM or Cred, and you were running marketing there at Sprinklr. So back then, we were very, very focused on social media and analytics, but now you're in this crypto game. Tell me, what was the reason for the pivot?
Yeah, well, as you said in a previous podcast, one of the most important things that you advocate for people is to be digitally curious. And I have lived that mantra my entire life. And so as I was finishing sort of my mission at Sprinklr, I started to think about what should I be curious about next? And I had been exposed to Bitcoin in 2013, didn't buy enough and all of that problem. But I was curious, what exactly are these Bitcoin and why do people think they're a big deal? So I spent a couple months doing a deep dive and emerged convinced that crypto and the crypto economic systems that they are going to bring with them represent a third alternative to the stark choices that we currently face on the global stage. And I've spent the last 4 years as a student, an advocate, consultant, speaker, writer, and investor in the crypto space trying to bring about what I call the crypto future.
So crypto, I think in many ways is misunderstood, and I have no skin in the game. I own, I think, 20 pounds worth of Bitcoin, so I'm never going to be a millionaire. Where do you think is the most misunderstood part of the technology and the application?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think it's misunderstood in many ways. I think people, I don't even know where to start to answer that question because there's so many areas where it's misunderstood. The first thing is it's not only used for money laundering and criminal activities. So I think that's number one. And number two is I don't think crypto by itself is going to be the cause of significant climate disaster or ecological breakdown. So I think those are important things. But I think the big thing to walk away with is if you think about it, you and I have been in the internet and social media game for a long time, but there is no native currency to the internet. We have an information superhighway, which goes all the way back to the late 90s, but we don't have an economic system and a way of transferring value that is as equally as efficient, low cost, and fast as the information transfer. So what crypto represents, I believe, is the next logical step in the evolution of the internet. And it's really the second side to the coin, pun intended, around the information revolution that the internet brought. This is the value transfer revolution component that can only be built once the information infrastructure has been built out, which we've obviously seen over the last 20 years. So I think what most people don't understand is this is a natural complement to the seismic change in information technology that we've seen over the last 20 years. And it just extends it and makes it even more powerful and more accessible to billions of people around the world.
So it was 10 plus years ago that this anonymous Satoru Nakamoto, or whoever he or she is, and we can talk about that at length as well, wrote the famous white paper. That's 10 years ago. And back then, cloud computing was in its infancy, broadband was in its infancy. Do you think if they were to develop it again in 2019, they would do it differently? knowing what we know now? You're a scholar of this space. If you were charged with redeveloping the blockchain technology and Bitcoin and other things on top of that, what would you do differently 10 years on?
That's a great question. Well, it's interesting because a lot of people are trying to do exactly that. I mean, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of different blockchain implementations and networks being experimented with currently. I think right now it's hard to say that there's a better way of doing it, because the beautiful thing, in my opinion, or the elegant thing behind Bitcoin, is that the way that security is provided to this network. And remember, at the end of the day, all the blockchain is a ledger that has global consensus or agreement about who owns what at what time. And the way that the participants who provide the security to the network demonstrate their investment is through something called proof of work. Well, proof of work is nothing more than having demonstrated three things, or one thing, which is I've solved this particular puzzle or math problem at this time. And the only way to solve that problem is by actually investing electricity and computing power. But that is, you mentioned the word skin in the game, and that's the essence of the Bitcoin blockchain, which is you demonstrate that you have contributed some, you put some skin in the game, and that in aggregate is what provides the security to the network to provide this global layer of trust around who owns what at what time, property rights, financial allocations, and what have you.
I understand that blockchain and Bitcoin was developed because there was a lack of trust, and so it was solving the trust problem. But if I have a trusted relationship with a supplier, if at the moment we have APIs with each other, we have a commercial agreement, could we not just use a distributed database? And this is, again, the cynic in me. Does it always need to be a blockchain solution, or can it be a hybrid, or are there areas where blockchain is maybe not the most efficient technology used because of the overhead of the trust factor? As you know, proof of work is statistically and computationally very, very complex, and it drains a lot of power and everything else. But if you have that trusted relationship, is blockchain always the right solution?
Oh, definitely not. I mean, there are certainly plenty of situations where it may not be the best fit, and that's totally fine. I mean, if you do have a totally trusted relationship, or you want to keep a network that's closed, there's no reason to make all the investments on an open public blockchain. I mean, the analogy I tend to use is that if you remember back to the late 90s, when the internet, the commercial internet, started to pick up steam, there were sort of two reactions. The first reaction is the one that's most typical as new technologies come on the scene, which is, hey, how can we use this technology to do what we already do better, faster, cheaper? Which is why, you know, in 98, 99, if you recall, there was a good year where everyone talked about corporate intranets. Intranets were all the rage. And don't get me wrong, intranets have a ton of value. And you should do it. You save money, save time, all that kind of stuff. And distributed ledger technology can do that. But as we both know, and everybody listening knows, the real value is created on the open public internet. So I think the same thing's going to happen with blockchains. You'll have a couple, they call them private blockchains. To me, it's just calling it a distributed ledger. Like you said, if you have a trusted relationship, you don't need the computational overhead, whether you use proof of work or proof of stake or any of the other proofs systems that they have there. But it's the open public blockchains where I believe that trillions of dollars worth of value, all powered by these various crypto assets, are going to exist. It's, you know, this is where you can handle micropayments that you cannot do it with the existing financial system. It's where it's potentially a much more cost-effective way of allocating risk and capital. It's uniquely suited, I think, when the engineering part gets resolved, for solving some of these large-scale global problems that we're facing. And ultimately, I think there's a really improved cost and risk structure. You know, I think right now we're at a very interesting time in history where we're sort of faced with these two choices of societies and governments. You know, we have sort of the Chinese model that's sort of going off in its own direction, looking strong. And then we have the Western model, which is obviously, I don't need to tell anyone who lives in the UK how much stress that's under right now. You think about the economy and the way that our governments and our economies are built for the industrial era. They're built for the world of things and material items. Well, the last 15, 20 years have shown us now it's software eating the world. It's becoming a more intangible. We need to dematerialize. We need to integrate all these sensors. You need to pay for access to, you know, some remote IoT device somewhere. Well, you can't swipe a credit card to do that. You also need to solve these problems around global poverty and migration and all the 2 billion people in the world who don't have bank accounts. You know, there's all these issues that are facing us, which I just don't believe can be effectively addressed by these centralized institutions that we currently have, because they're sort of built on a previous paradigm of you know, industrial age economies. And we have to create a global trust layer, especially when our leaders don't seem to be stepping up to create, you know, they're putting up walls instead of continuing to reduce the walls and allow people to improve their lives through trade and through, you know, feeling like their voice matters. And I think that's what crypto, by respecting property rights and, you know, the fancy word people use is self-sovereignty. I think that it offers the potential to ameliorate many of these issues. It's not perfect. Don't get me wrong. We're going to have a whole new slew of problems, just like I didn't see fake news coming when I was evangelizing for social media. I'm sure there are plenty of things I don't see. But fundamentally, particularly in industries that require a high degree of consumer trust, like insurance or remittances and even social media, as these calls for stakeholder capitalism as sort of the next level of or the next iteration of capitalism are intensifying, I think when these crypto economic networks start to mature from a technology perspective, that value is going to migrate to them, because they're just going to be better, faster, cheaper, and also, most importantly, significantly lower risk.
Totally agree with you. And I think fundamentally the social impact question is something that can be solved over time. We'll talk about the elephant in the room, Libra, in a second, because that leads on to something you've said. But I think the issue is that I haven't seen a technology get adopted so quickly and reach the headline so quickly as crypto. So I was probably an early adopter. I had a website in 1994. I've been on the internet since 1983, or dial up and everything else. I had my first mobile phone in 1994. I am the poster child for an early adopter. I try this new technology. And so you look at how quickly the friends around me and my family got mobile phones. It took years, not months. I think the problem, if you like, with blockchain, Bitcoin, is that it's about money. And humans are fundamentally greedy. And so when people think they can make money very quickly, it reaches the front page. So here in the UK, back in November 2017, so 2 years ago, Bitcoin was on the front page of all the newspapers because it was news. Because 1 minute it was worth £5,000, then it was £10,000. And I actually bought some Bitcoin, I think the day it was at its peak. And I talk about this to clients, that I bought Bitcoin not to get rich. I bought £20 worth through Coinbase. I bought it for two reasons. One is to find out what it felt like to own cryptocurrency and to hold it. And I remember refreshing the Coinbase app in the afternoon where I bought it, and £20 became 22, then it was 23, 26, 21. I thought, this is crazy. I'm doing nothing. I'm not doing anything to improve the value of this currency, if you could call it a currency, but it's going up and down. And then when I tried to convert it back into fiat, back into pound, it took me 4 weeks and two banks. But I think the reason it's got such quick press is that it's about money, and everyone wants to get rich quick. And if you can sit there and sit on an app and refresh it, and the value goes up and down, I think that's exciting for some people. But then we're recording this in November 2019 for reference. So recently, Mr. Zuckerberg's been before Congress again, ostensibly to talk about his crypto platform Libra, but essentially they wanted to grill him about everything else. What's your view on Libra? Will it succeed? Was it put together the right way? And does Facebook have the right ambition and ethical ambition to lead this, do you think?
Well, before we get to Facebook, I guess I would maybe challenge what you said, or just, I'm not sure I accept that it's entirely about money. Yeah, and I'm okay with that. I mean, if you know, every new technology goes through these initial booms. I mean, this is the Gartner hype cycle all over again. And we're just kind of in that semi-trough of disillusionment phase right now. And that's fine. I mean, you remember the internet in the 2000 to 2004 era. It had been on the front pages, and then it disappeared for a couple of years, only for Facebook to be launched in 2004 and Twitter in 2007 and LinkedIn somewhere around there also. So like that's the natural flow of these technologies. So while the massive increase in value certainly garnered headlines, like I don't think that's what it's all about, the same way the internet's not just about making money. I mean, there's certainly a money to be made in there, but I think it's much more about giving people more control over at a high level, their lives, but really more control over their value, the value they have, their money, more control over their data and their information, and being able to have a little bit more, agency in how their lives are lived. You know, we have these sort of interesting sort of juxtapositions of life right now. On the one hand, you know, we're seeing this massive increase in bandwidth and wireless coverage and computing power, but at the same time, we're having this ridiculous destruction of trust in traditional institutions, you know, income and wealth inequality on one hand, and it's just going to get exacerbated as, you know, more and more gets pushed into these, you know, smaller organizations that accrue more and more value in the centralized, like we're seeing with the FANG stocks or what have you. But you have more information in your hands. It's like the classic about the more power than the rocket going to the moon kind of thing. But surveillance capitalism or total surveillance state is becoming, commonplace. So we're having these tensions that are affecting our current system. And I think that's what this movement is really about, which is we can have the benefits of a globally interconnected world where people's lives are improved through trade without having to compromise on our personal privacy, on our rights, on the things that allow us to feel some degree of safety as we go about our daily lives and have more say in what we're doing. So I think that's what it's all about. Coming to Libra, you know, I've never been a big fan of Libra. I mean, I understand why Facebook's doing it because it's basically free money for them and they have massive distribution. But to me, you're replacing one problem with another, which is, in general, centralized currencies. And I don't want to get like too crazy here, but centralized fiat currencies are ultimately, they're a risky proposition for the people who hold the currencies. You know, and inflation is the erosionary process that eats away at our value. So that all comes back to the fact that by holding Bitcoin, you said you weren't doing anything to add value to the network. And I actually don't agree with you. By holding onto Bitcoin, you are putting skin in the game. You are saying, I'm going to hold this. Remember, there's a fixed supply of Bitcoin. There are 21 million. So if you hold on it and other people increase, you know, their interest in it, that increases the value of it. Whereas if you sell it, it decreases the value. So simply by holding it and saying, I'm in this for the long term, you are, you know, contributing in some small way to the network. So I think what's challenging right now here, I read a great article recently that talked about the offering of railroad stock in the 1850s in the UK. And it was the first time, I mean, really where anyone could access, have shares in a company. And most people just could not get their head around it. It's just like, well, I can't use this share to actually travel on the railroad. I can't actually do anything with it. I'm just supposed to hold it. Well, now you'd be an idiot for not holding shares. And I think we're just seeing this emergence of a new type of participatory capitalism that was previously didn't exist. And I understand it's a new paradigm and it is difficult to get our heads around. But this is how history evolves, is that we have these new innovations allowing more people to more access to create more wealth and improve lives. And to me, that's what crypto economic systems supported by decentralized blockchain based infrastructure are going to afford us. And hopefully we can leverage them to distribute wealth a little bit more equally and solve some of these issues in a way that actually represents the public, the common good.
So you make a lot of sense in all your points, and I can see a lot of stuff you're saying. And you've been looking at this closely and playing with it for the last 4+ years. And podcasts like this are one way to get that message out, but we can't get into everyone's ears. whose responsibility is it to talk up the benefits that you've said? Is it, obviously, it's a bit of an echo chamber, a bit like social media. All the social media geeks talk about social media. But how do we talk about the positive benefits? And whose role is it? Is it government? Is it Facebook? Is it you? Is it me? How do we get the message out there? Because there are so many actors in the game, and some are good actors and some are bad actors.
What's beautiful in my mind about crypto is it's not one person's responsibility. It's anyone who's a member, who's an owner of the network. By having one Bitcoin or one Ether or one whatever token, you are an owner of that organization. So I think one of the books I've written on this topic is called The Decentralized Marketing Organization. It's that everybody is part of the marketing organization right now simply by being a token holder. But I think as the technology matures, and you talked about, you know, you're an early adopter, and I say, look, we're at like the 14.4, you know, dial-up modem days, maybe 28A. And I'm coming to you and I'm saying, Andrew, one day you're going to be able to watch any episode of Friends that you want at any point, at any time, and you're going to be able to do it in your car. And you're like, Jeremy, you are smoking way too much stuff. There is no way that's going to happen. And I'm like, no, Andrew, the innovation part's done. It's the engineering part now that has to be addressed. It will get addressed. But the innovation of how do you transfer data, we've solved that. And I think with crypto, we're seeing that. I'll give you like a couple stories that really, sorry, I get super excited about this stuff. You know, I heard a phenomenal story coming out of Sri Lanka where, you know, in Sri Lanka, there are farmers who are living right on the edge of poverty, and especially they're at risk to climate related, challenges or destruction of their crop. Well, there's no cost effective way for an insurance company, because 30% of our insurance premiums now just go to overhead for insurance companies. There's no cost effective way for them to provide an insurance policy to a rice farmer in Sri Lanka who's living on the edge of poverty. However, there is a decentralized insurance platform called Etherisk, E-T-H-E-R-I-S-C. And basically, they've created a smart contract-based insurance policy that is triggered based on a couple of inputs. Say, you know, if there's X amount of rain in a given district, it automatically pays out the premium to that farmer. Now, the difference of a rapid fire insurance or a rapidly distributed insurance payment to a farmer on the edge of poverty in Sri Lanka is basically, and I might be slightly dramatic here, but it's basically the difference between having to like sell a child into like the sex trade versus, you know, being able to make it till the next planting season. Okay, that might be a slight exaggeration, but like that's how, you know, fragile many of these lives are. You cannot make that contract work in a traditional system. It is literally impossible. I sent a donation to a nonprofit in Venezuela with Bitcoin, and I sent the donation for like a fraction of a cent. How, you cannot do that with the current system. You know, all of these people who are underserved, who then abandon their cities and or towns and villages and then make their way up to the global north, you know, part of it is because we can't provide them access to the financial good services that all of us in sort of the Western world take for granted. Remittance fees, if you're, you know, all the money that's going back to these countries, like, you know, 18% fees. Why should we penalizing the poorest people on the planet? We shouldn't. And that's what these types of technologies can now do, to cost effectively provide insurance, to cost effectively deliver remittances, and to give more people access to credit and lending services that, you know, the rest of us take for granted, because we know those are the building blocks of wealth and security that we want everybody to have. And there's no other way to do it. This technology, and yes, it's early and it's immature, and there are all types of reasons why it's not ready for prime time. And it's frustrating for me because I wish it was here yesterday. You know, it can deliver it, and the current system just is not able to do it from a technology perspective.
So as this is the Practical Futurist podcast, I want to give my listeners three things they can do next week, not next month. So is it education? Is it investment? What three things should they be doing next week?
I think everybody should read the Bitcoin white paper. It's like 14 pages. It's my kids have read it. So it's not
challenging. You can get it. I mean, granted, my kids are, of course, incredibly brilliant, but, you know, I think anyone can get that. So the Bitcoin white paper, it's free. Download it, read it once or twice. You'll already be way ahead. Number two is, I think you alluded to it before, which is you just need to go buy some. Not, you don't have to put as much, but 20 pounds, 100 pounds, whatever, you know, money you can afford to lose for sure. But once you have it, I would encourage you to sort of find something you can do with it, whether it just send it to someone else. I mean, I had one story I like to tell people is I had two clients. One, they each owed me about $1,000 worth of expenses. One was in Switzerland, one was in the UK. The Swiss ones wanted to do everything with the traditional financial system. It took 3 weeks, three rejections, and $71 in fees. The ones in the UK sent me in crypto. It took 10 seconds and 4 cents in fees. So I would encourage people to start experimenting with these this technology and play around with it. And I'd say those are the three: is go read the white paper, get a little crypto, and then find one way to transact in it, if only to understand and get your head around it. I think you can do all of that in about, you know, an hour next week, but at least you'll start to get your hands dirty. And I know you, as a digitally curious veteran, encourage and believe in that, because that's the best way to understand the tech, is just get your hands a little bit dirty.
How can people find out more about you and your work?
Twitter is always good, JER979, and I blog 5 days a week on blog.neverstopmarketing.com, a wide range of topics, emerging technology, but definitely heavily focused on crypto.
Jeremy, thank you so much for your time. I've learned a lot today.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm grateful for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to the Practical Futurist podcast. You can find all of our previous shows at futurist.london. And if you like what you've heard on the show, please consider subscribing via your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. You can find out more about Andrew and how he helps corporates navigate a disruptive digital world with keynote speeches and C-suite workshops at futurist.london. Until next time, this has been the Practical Futurist Podcast.